Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this episode. But first, you're going to be going to a lot of holiday parties soon, and you're going to need an ugly sweater. But you'll likely be going to parties where, you know, garment lines and cocoa are chic, and to parties where tattoos and coffee are the norm. Now, what could possibly fit both occasions? Never fear! Sunstone has your back and your front with our line of ugly Christmas sweaters. You can choose from three catchy designs made by our own Grace Poole that can perform with or without irony, making both your TBM and post-Mormon friends giggle. Head over to sunstone.org to pick up your favorite sweaters. And because this is our end-of-year fundraiser, we have magnanimously taken the limit off of how much you can choose to pay for a sweater. That's right! Pay as much as you want, starting at $45, and it will be counted as a donation to Sunstone, tax-deductible to the extent allowed by law. And the more you donate for a sweater, the more power it gains, until it can levitate tinsel with just the residue of unused tithing blessings. Because being a nonprofit, Sunstone runs on donations. Seriously, we don't make any money around here. Thank you so much for supporting us and our mission to make the world the kind of place where there is always more than one way to Mormon. Now, Mormon Studies lost an intellectual and spiritual titan on October 29th, 2023, when Levina Fielding Anderson passed away. Did you know Levina? She was a huge part of Mormon Studies for decades. During the 1970s, she was an editor at the Ensign, but she was unceremoniously fired when she shared the text of a talk that had already been given at General Conference with Sunstone, because Sunstone wanted to do a comparison between the speech that had been given at conference and the text that was published in the conference report. So, Levina started her own editing company, and over the next 40 years, she was the midwife to hundreds of articles and books on Mormonism. She was also an editor at the Journal of Mormon History and a member of the board of editors at the Signature Books, all the while producing many articles and books of her own. She actually received a Smith Pettit Award for outstanding contribution to Mormon letters in 2018. But the thing she's probably best known for is being one of the September Six, a group of six scholars who were excommunicated in September of 1993, for an article that she presented at two Sunstone symposiums and published in Dialogue, called The LDS Intellectual Community and Church Leadership, a Contemporary Chronology. But despite being excommunicated, she continued going to her ward faithfully, fulfilling whatever callings they would give her, which, in this case, was piano player in Relief Society, which was apparently something the church handbook said could be done by a non-member. So, to honor Levina, here's an article that she published in Sunstone in October of 1990, 3 years before she was excommunicated. I think it encapsulates her intelligence, her insight, her humanity, and her spirituality. It's called In the Garden God Hath Planted, Explorations Toward a Maturing Faith. When I was teaching freshman English at the University of Washington in 1969, I had a very bright Chinese-American student who uncharacteristically missed two classes in a row. When he showed up for the third class, I asked where he'd been. "I was in my room," Gary said. "I couldn't think of a good reason to come out." I spent the rest of the afternoon with him just talking, trying to understand why this bright, competent, hitherto motivated young man was suffering an existential crisis of enormous proportions. He had experienced no triggering trauma, but he had been overwhelmed by the meaninglessness of life. He literally could not find any good reason to continue living, though he was not particularly suicidal. As we talked, I caught a glimpse of his universe, a black hole that pulled into it all sparks of awareness, remorselessly extinguishing them one by one. I sense the crippling and crushing that happens to someone who looks out into the universe and sees not the face of a loving father and mother, but blackness whirling toward oblivion. And I wondered about myself. Why, despite my glib graduate school discussions of angst and existential despair, had I never taken either seriously? Why, even as I saw Gary's universe, did I sense beneath my feet and at my back, as solid as granite, a loving and attentive presence? Whatever I identify as my consciousness is anchored in and shared with the consciousness of God. Inseparably connected with that attentive, loving presence, I can't remember a time when this has not been so. My patriarchal blessing, bestowed upon me at the age of 11, told me, quote, "You have received a testimony of the gospel, knowing within your heart that God lives, that Jesus is the Christ and the Savior of all mankind," unquote. I do know. I accept that gift of faith as pure grace. I grew up in a devout and loving home with five brothers and sisters on farms in southern Idaho and central Washington. Ours was a household of faith and miracles. Miracles of healing, miracles of protection, miracles of adverse weather controlled. Ours was also a household committed to the church. My father was a bishop twice and built two chapels. My mother taught primary for 45 years. Both were returned missionaries. All of us children married in the temple. Two of my brothers and I went on missions. The grandsons are following suit. Furthermore, I had the immense good fortune to be persecuted for my religion when I was growing up. My family moved from a solidly Mormon community in Idaho when I was about 12 to the Columbia Basin in Washington, where construction on the Grand Coulee Dam had made it possible to bring thousands of acres under cultivation. One side effect was to upset the existing agricultural base of dryland farming, much of it by families who had been in the area for more than a generation. The only church in town to that point had been a comfortable little congregational church. Since many of the new farmers came from Mormon areas of Idaho and Utah, the economic differences coincided with the religious differences. The congregational minister responded by preaching openly anti-Mormon sermons that were, for a time, quite popular with his parishioners. The natural problems of integrating newcomers with old and well-established families were thus exacerbated by religious suspicions. I have to admit that the persecution amounted only to mild social ostracism and very mild name-calling, carrot snappers for Mormons. Our school was too little to turn up its nose at the husky Mormon athletes, and you didn't have to have a date to go to anywhere except to the junior prom. Thus, with very little inconvenience or distress to me, I chose Mormonism and its values as my own, solidifying my already firm Mormon identity and bonding culturally with my own community. The most important predictive fact about me was that I was Mormon. It explained me, summarized me, justified me. As I grew into consciousness of myself as a person, it was as a Mormon person, identified wholly with what I perceived to be the major values and norms of the church. My mission in France, graduating twice from BYU, and spending 7.5 years on the staff of the Ensign, were all experiences that both deepened and challenged my simple one-to-one identification with the church. I am still a Mormon, a committed, believing Mormon. I never considered marrying outside the church. And Paul's own strong testimony and active family were both attractions to me when I married. He's been on a bishopric and on a high council. He resigned from that position to teach our son's primary class. We pay tithing, we have temple recommends, we attend church weekly, study scriptures, have family home evening and family prayers. I subscribe to and read all of the church magazines. I've taught primary since age 14, with a few gaps, and currently teach Sunbeams and run a den of Cub Scouts. I've been a visiting teacher since age 19. We feel deeply blessed with a loving family life, stimulating work, good friends, good health. We acknowledge the Lord's hand in these blessings. In short, there are many ways in which the word Mormon summarizes the most important things about me. But Mormon is not the only adjective I would use today. Two others are intellectual and feminist. These are aspects of myself that the church does not approve, reinforce, or encourage. Instead, the message that I hear is one of denial, repression, or suspicion. Intellectually, the church, through BYU, gave me what I consider to be a first-rate education and reinforced a powerful hunger for learning. But now, I find the official attitude toward scholarship in general, and Mormon studies in particular, to be quite dismaying. As a woman, I feel deeply alienated from the structure of the church. Theologically, it offers a vision of godhood that includes the feminine principle in the form of a mother in heaven, who is, like our Father in heaven, divine. But as a practical matter, the church defines women primarily as child-rearers and husband-nurturers, steers women into supportive roles organizationally, uses their labor to operate important programs, but withholds from them the final financial and managerial authority it grants to men, and gives men an apparently preferential treatment with God through their ordination to the priesthood. I know many other intellectuals and feminists, with whom I share much, who have become disaffected and disappointed with the church. Some have drifted away, as the saying is. Others have marched out, slamming the door behind them. Neither is a viable choice for me. God does not speak to me only through the church, nor does God speak to me in everything the church says. But I still hear that divine voice in many of the church's messages. I accept the beauty of its community, the authority of its ordinances, its shaping of the vessel from which we may drink the waters of life. Over the years, as I've found my own identity taking shape in a pattern different from what the church prescribes for women, I've also found my understanding of God developing in some non-correlated ways. Two aspects of God's character that I'm searching to understand most keenly right now are diversity and free agency. First, diversity. Recently, I stood in a little meadow below our cabin in Lamb's Canyon, up to my waist in green plants. Slowly, I rotated in a circle, looking at what was growing within a 3-foot radius. I'd counted 23 different varieties, none of them trees or shrubs, none of them flowering, all of them a different shade of green. To perceive each of those aspects of green, texture, and shape, without being able to name them, describe them, or even remember them accurately, was an exhilarating revelation of how highly God values diversity in even little things. God doesn't plant lawns. He plants meadows. But we belong to a church that currently values lawns, their sameness, their conformity, the ease with which they can all be cut to the same height, watered on schedule, and replaced by new turf if necessary, and against which it is easy to spot dandelions. All organizations are limited in their ability to handle diversity, but our church seems particularly limited right now in its ability to cherish and nurture individuals, as wild geraniums, catnip, western cone flowers, or yarrow, not as identical blades of grass in a uniformly green lawn. When Joseph Smith said that he taught his people correct principles and let them govern themselves, I've usually assumed that this must be God's method too. Now I'm not so sure. I think rather that he expects us to identify those correct principles out of the floods and torrents of raw experience with which he drenches us daily, experiences of good and evil and every gradation in between. Some of those principles will make us more like him. Others will take us away from him. Our choices relentlessly reveal the true desires of our hearts, no matter what our lips might say. When we find principles that work for us, principles that teach us the manner of happiness, then we naturally try to share them with others. When a group of us shares the same principles, we have a community. The church teaches many of these principles, but I no longer believe that it teaches all of them. Nor do I believe that the church is the only place we should seek them. I now believe at this stage in my life in the fundamental holiness of diversity. One of the results of this discovery, along with the humbling revelation of how easily I myself drift toward conformity, is an evolution in my understanding of revelation and how it comes. I grew up, probably like most of us, with the telephone model of revelation. The red phone rings. The prophet, who has been sitting there staring at it alertly, seizes it. God dictates a crisp sentence. The prophet scribbles it down, says, "Right, chief," and comes out into the room where we're all sitting on folding aluminum chairs holding our notepads and pencils. He announces, "Now hear this. The gymnasiums will get red indoor-outdoor carpeting with basketball courts printed on them," or whatever the message du jour happens to be. I now believe that we get revelation from many sources, sometimes clearly, sometimes emerging from conflicting points of view, sometimes as personal discoveries, sometimes brought to us by other people. The model of revelation that now makes more sense to me is that all of us are working in a madhouse, a zoo. There are lots of phones and they're all ringing. People are talking into them as well as listening. They're also talking to each other. We say, "Just a sec, Joan, I've got a call coming in," or, "Let me put you on hold, God, somebody's waving a memo at me." Sometimes the message on the telephone is, "Joan's got the memo you need." Sometimes the messages contradict each other. There are also non-messages going on. There's background music. There are word processors clicking, printers clacking, videos flashing. You can hear birds, cars, and helicopters from outside. Some people are slamming file drawers open and shut, looking for last week's messages. And these messages are all very important. They're about lunch. Lunch is free, but the schedule is uncertain. Who gets to go when, what the menu is, whom you get to sit by, how long you get. The hungrier you are, the more numbers you punch, files you search, people you ask. And quite frequently, lunch appears on your desk while you're not looking because somebody ordered pizza on one of those phone calls. And even when you go to the Sky Room, where it's served on a lovely linen tablecloth, there are still phones. People at the same table talking, people at adjoining tables whose conversations you overhear, background music, birds, and an occasional colossal crash from the kitchen where somebody tried to enter through the exit. Revelation is not an orderly, linear process. It can be a sunburst of insight, a glimmer of comprehension, the rethinking with understanding of long past events, the testing of a beloved principle in an unforeseen crucible. But most important of all, it's our experience. Even if it begins with instructions from elsewhere, it must become our experience before it becomes our revelation. The second principle, free agency, is even more fundamental than diversity, since diversity could not exist without it. As I grew up, I learned in Sunday school and seminary that free agency was a kind of true-false quiz, or at best a multiple-choice test. The freedom to make right choices, as defined by the rule books in the hands of our teachers. I no longer believe in this view of freedom. We are far from understanding the absolute and deadly seriousness with which God regards our free agency. Contemplate, if you will, his profound reluctance to tamper with it, no matter what is at stake. His terrible patience as we make choices, sometimes stupid, sometimes irresponsible, sometimes downright dangerous. I believe that he suffers with us as we learn the consequences of some choices, suffers so profoundly that only the atonement could preserve for us the continued ability to choose. Other decisions he celebrates with us. Jesus didn't say, "Read my mind." He said, "Follow me." That divine invitation sets us in motion. Freedom is a dance that we enter into, understanding only as we move that each gesture flings grace or grief into the far reaches of the universe. It is a dance with life, with death, and ultimately, with the light that fills the immensities of space, where no space exists without kingdom. This view of free agency has developed in large measure from my struggle to understand why history in general, and Mormon history in particular, has taken some of the directions it has. Let's look at Joseph Smith for an example. Linda King Newell's and Valene Tippett Avery's biography of Emma Hale Smith was deeply disturbing to me for the documentation it provided about Joseph Smith and the origins of polygamy. Michael Quinn's examination of the termination of polygamy raised painful and poignant questions about intention and deception on the part of Joseph's successors. Richard Bushman, Jan Shipps, and Michael Quinn responsibly, sensitively, and exhaustively examined the rather distasteful role of folk religion in the first decades of Mormonism. I had to take this information seriously. You see, I love Joseph Smith. I do not feel betrayed and angry if Joseph was wrong or mistaken or misled, and I think that he sometimes was. Those times were direct results of his free agency. Certainly, God spoke to him. God speaks to everyone. But Joseph listened better than a lot of us, and actually entered into a dialogue that lasted for the rest of his life. It is the listening and the dialogue that are the models for us, I believe, not whatever notes he jotted down in the course of that ongoing conversation. Let me be more specific. I was shocked and disgusted to discover that Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old girl, probably consummated that marriage, and concealed it from Emma. My image of prophet did not accommodate this kind of behavior. I could not begin to find holy motives for such behavior. I also felt deeply guilty, naturally, to feel this way about a prophet. Not just a prophet either, but the prophet. I took my indignation and guilt to the Lord in prayer over a period of time. I don't recall being particularly sophisticated or eloquent in my petition. It was more along the lines of, "If Joseph Smith did this, and it looks as if he did, then he was a real jerk. What do you have to say about it?" You know, on some level, I wasn't even expecting an answer, but I got one. From that attentive, loving presence, gently, tenderly, and with finality, came the words, "Joseph is mine. He is in my hands." God did not agree with me that Joseph was a jerk. He did not even agree that Joseph had made a mistake. He acknowledged my grief and upheld me in those same hands that were holding Joseph, and that upheld Helen Mar Whitney, not only at age 14, but for the rest of her long life. I have the feeling, though, that if I hadn't acknowledged my outrage and hadn't protested it to the Lord, that I probably wouldn't have got that answer. As a result, my affection for Joseph Smith is, if anything, increased by this new information about him. And I want to know more. I want to know everything I can, because I love him, not because I'm trying to decide whether he is worthy of my love. Freedom and diversity intersect not in rules, not in regulations, but in relationships. The ultimate value of that experience for me was not what I learned about prayer or even about Joseph Smith, but what I experienced in that loving relationship. Well, these are the discoveries that I'm just now making. They are far from the final word in the divine dialogue that I hope will last for the rest of my life. We belong to a church that, for the time being, enforces and rewards conformity, hierarchy, and obedience. I think that this direction is an experiment, the result of choices perhaps instigated by some leaders, but in which we have cooperated. It happens to be an experiment which tacitly encourages adults to remain dependent, and which exacts a particularly high price from its women. I think God is watching it, with loving attentiveness, and with a terrible patience. Patience is hard, but I plan to still be here when the church stops experimenting with lawns and refocuses on the garden which the Lord hath planted. The glory of the church, realized in many shining ways even now, is the ability to foster conditions in which richly loving relationships can thrive, with each other, with God. And ultimately, it is these relationships that are our defense against the darkness of despair. Then shall the Lord, quote, comfort Zion, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Well, thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sunstone Podcast. Remember to stop by sunstone.org to pick up your ugly sweaters, or if you just want to send some financial love directly our way, go to sunstone.org/donate. Thanks so much for your support. I'll talk with you again next time.